Chapter 30. Two Little Horns. It seemed that in January, winter decided to strike with full force. The first week after the holidays, the Bible seminar had to be cancelled. Snow flurries and high winds made night driving too treacherous, and schools were even shut down for the day. During that blustery week, a nasty flu ran its course through the Simons household. For a while, there was plenty of sneezing and coughing going on, and everyone was drinking hot lemon tea with honey to soothe their sore throats. However, the house was warm inside, and sickness and stormy weather kept them all together. Craig and Beth had decided that Jessica could go to Jamaica, and she was busy making plans to leave. She'd booked a flight for the last day of January and was in regular contact with the other young people on the team. Including her, there were two young ladies, two young men, and an older couple to provide the leadership. The group was coming together from all over North America. One young man was flying out from California, another from Texas, and the other young lady was from British Columbia. With the howling cold winds and a raging sore throat, Peter thought 6 months in Jamaica would be a welcome change for anyone, but he knew that wasn't Jessica's motivation. There only seemed to be one thing that disappointed Jessica when she talked about her trip, and that was that she would miss the Antichrist debate by 1 week. However, she also didn't want to let a team down by arriving late, as they were all planning to arrive in Jamaica on the very same day. The second Tuesday evening in January was a clear, starry night. The roads were scraped bare, and everyone was feeling healthy again, except Peter. Unfortunately, Peter was still coughing, sneezing, and highly contagious. So, as much as he was looking forward to the class on Daniel chapters 7 and 8, he knew it wouldn't be fair to spread his germs to others. "I'll fill you in on the details tomorrow night," Craig promised, walking past the couch where Peter reclined to pick up his Bible from the coffee table. He patted him on the head kindly, saying, "I hope you get a good sleep tonight." Jessica came walking out of the kitchen with a mug in her hands. "My mum made you another hot lemon tea," she said to Peter, carefully placing it on the end table nearby. Then she handed him a small package. "Try these lozenges. The lady at the drugstore said they're really good." "Thanks, Jess," Peter said hoarsely. He noticed the package wasn't opened. "When did you pick these up?"
"Today."
"For me?"
"Of course," she replied with a smile, turning pink.
Peter had come to realize that Jessica turned pink at least once a day.
"You're the only one who's still sick."
Peter watched her pick up her Bible from the coffee table and walk towards the hallway. How he wished he were heading out as well. The topic they planned to consider tonight was one he had struggled to understand.
"Don't forget to take some vitamin C," Jessica reminded him with a smile as they all waved goodbye.
"Yes, Mum," Peter grinned. The look on Jessica's face made Peter laugh. She was rather fun to tease. She blushed in varying degrees of intensity, so it was easy to gauge how embarrassed she was. Peter was now fully confident that Jessica could take a joke, but he hadn't determined why she was so hard to get to know. Any conversations between them were almost always at his initiation. Did she still feel intimidated or disappointed? Or were there other reasons? Sometimes Peter found her perplexingly aloof. It was rather lonely staying in the Simons house without any of the others around, but Peter was weary and ready to crawl into bed. He slowly made his way down to his room. Beth's lemon tea was soothing, and so were the lozenges. Sitting up in bed, he briefly looked at his study sheet. He had tried to do the study a week ago, but had found it rather confusing. Tonight his head felt so thick and muddled that he doubted he would be able to sort through it any better. Still, he wanted to remember what it was all about. However, he fell fast asleep before he'd even read the first page. The next evening, after they had finished the daily Bible readings, Craig offered to discuss the two little horns with Peter, just as he had promised. Beth left to visit two elderly women, and Alan had homework to do, but Jess stayed with them in the living room. With the tissue box beside him and the last lozenge in his mouth, Peter was at least feeling better than he had the day before. "We had a good session last night," Craig told Peter. "Tony and Sue were out again, and they even had a few of their friends with them. They've heard about the upcoming debate, and somehow they figure it's going to settle the matter once and for all." Peter nodded. He was glad to hear that Tony and Sue weren't afraid to thoroughly search out both sides of the issue. They had such a keen attitude. Studying the Bible wasn't just a hobby for them. They really wanted to know the truth and to live it. "How's Derek?" Peter asked,
thinking that maybe he should give him a call. It had been so long since they'd seen each other.
"He's lost his job," Craig replied.
"He had an apprenticeship with his uncle, and for some reason that's been cut off."
"I'll have to give him a call," Peter said.
"Other than that, he's okay?"
"Seems to be," Craig smiled. "We had a long talk. Derek sure has Antichrist figured out."
"Almost everyone has figured out who Antichrist is," Jessica added with a smile.
"But some still haven't?" Peter asked. His voice was very hoarse.
"Fred is still making wild guesses," Craig replied. "And last night Linda suggested it might be the devil or Islamic fundamentalists."
"But you still didn't give them the answer?" Peter asked.
"They're hearing it from everyone else," Craig said. "But for some reason, Fred and Linda don't want to accept the obvious. However, I told them that if we were in a court of law trying to determine which suspect is guilty, then all the clues would have to show that we had a match. If even one clue didn't fit, then as good detectives, we'd have to dismiss that individual as a suspect." Peter picked up his study sheet from off the table in front of him and smoothed it out with his hand.
"So, since it's just the three of us tonight, Pete," Craig said, "why don't you tell me what you think the two visions are about?"
"Okay," Peter nodded. "I'll try my best, but I did get rather confused with some of it."
Craig promised to help him out, and Peter began in Daniel chapter 7.
"Well, the first little horn comes out of the fourth beast," he said.
"That terrible beast that Daniel saw in his vision, which represents the Roman Empire."
"You're correct," Craig agreed.
"So, it's a Roman little horn."
"And that terrible Roman beast had 10 horns on his head initially." Verse 24 of chapter 7 says that the 10 horns represent 10 kings, so I assume that must mean that the Roman beast controlled those other territories?
"Yes," Craig nodded.
"Rome controlled an enormous geographical region at the height of its power, ruling over most of the ancient world. While they allowed other countries to remain in their land, everyone had to pay homage and tribute to Caesar."
"Okay," Peter continued, after giving his nose a quick blow.
"So then this little horn uproots 3 horns and dominates the other 7. Only this little horn is a bit different from the others. He has eyes and a mouth. He speaks boastfully against God and persecutes the saints until Jesus destroys him, which is an obvious link to Antichrist. It says he will even intend to change times and laws."
"Did you determine what times and laws were?"
"No, I didn't," Peter admitted regretfully.
"That would be interesting to know."
Jessica leaned over to the bookshelf and pulled out the concordance.
"I'll look it up," she offered.
In a minute, she had the answer. "Times can also mean seasons, while law can also be decrees."
"How could anyone think they could change the seasons?"
Peter wondered out loud.
"Good question," Craig replied.
"Obviously no one can change the weather, but in the past there have been those in Roman positions that have altered the times, seasons, and laws that God has put into place."
"Really?"
Peter asked.
"Yes," Craig replied. "They have claimed to have such great authority that they are able to modify, declare, and even interpret divine laws, and that is elevating oneself above God."
Craig asked Peter if he had figured out the meaning of a time and times and the dividing of time, and Peter nodded. Using the information given on the study sheets, he had determined that it referred to 1260 days. That was how long the Roman little horn power was to have dominion over the true believers. Before they went on to look at the second little horn in chapter 8, Craig summarized the details of the first. "Let's remember that this little horn with the eyes and mouth developed out of the Roman Empire. It's guilty of speaking boastfully against God, persecuting true believers, and trying to change times and laws, God's times and laws. It has power over the saints for 1260 years. "One more detail in this prophecy, Pete," Craig went on to say, "is that this horn has eyes like the eyes of a man. In some way, it has extraordinary power to see. And since this is a symbolic vision, we aren't looking for a king with good eyesight, but a powerful system with a network to determine all that is going on in the world." Craig then asked Peter to tell him about the second little horn in chapter 8. After a few sneezes, Peter tried his best to explain. His voice was getting really hoarse. "Well, this vision only involves 2 animals," he relayed, "a ram and a male goat. And it's easy to explain, as the interpretation is given. The ram refers to Medo-Persia, while the male goat is Greece." Jessica got up from her chair without a word and walked over to the kitchen.
"That's right," Craig agreed, continuing on.
"Babylon isn't mentioned in this vision, because by this time, Babylon was under the rule of Nebuchadnezzar's grandson and about to fall into Medo-Persian hands. Together they briefly went through the similarities between the ram and the male goat to the beasts from Daniel chapter 7. Craig had a chart of all the beasts from Daniel's prophecies that corresponded with the image Nebuchadnezzar had seen in chapter 2. The Medo-Persian ram had one horn greater than the other, just like the bear was raised up on one side, because the Persians had dominated the Medes in their confederacy. And the Grecian goat in the vision of chapter 8 moved so quickly that he didn't even touch the ground. It was as if the goat were flying, just like the leopard with four wings. True to the prophecy, the Greeks conquered their territory very rapidly, in just 12 years. From history, Craig said, we know that the man who led the Greeks to victory, Alexander the Great, is still renowned for the swift speed at which he conquered the then known world. Now, what about the four horns of the male goat and four heads of the leopard? He asked Peter. What do they represent? Well, horns represent kings, so I guess there must have been four kings. Yes, kings or leaders, Craig replied. The male goat began with one great horn, representing Alexander. When Alexander died prematurely, his four Grecian generals divided up the conquered territory. Peter had a question. Is there anything in Daniel 8 about the Empire of Rome? In the other visions, Rome comes after the Greeks, but I didn't see Rome in this chapter, unless it's the king with fierce features. Ah, I believe the Roman power is in this chapter, Craig smiled. After the great horn was broken off the goat and four horns came up, what happened next? Peter had to examine the verses again to refresh his memory. A little horn grew from one of the four, was his reply. That's right, Craig agreed. But doesn't this little horn have Grecian connections? Craig nodded. Well, then I can't figure out how verses 8 to 12 fit in, Peter admitted. When did this second horn exalt himself as high as the prince of the host and take away the daily sacrifices and cast down the place of his sanctuary? Is this something that happened in the past, or will it occur in the future? At that moment, Jessica returned with two cups of hot lemon tea. She gave one to her dad and handed the other to Peter. You sound like you need this, she smiled. Peter took it from her appreciatively. The warm compassion in her eyes meant as much as the small act of kindness. It's just what I was hoping for, he grinned. Thanks. This section can be confusing, Craig nodded, as he blew on his cup of tea to cool it down. Unless you understand that the Roman system grew out of the Greek. And how is that? Well, you see, in 133 BC, the Grecian territory of Pergamum, in what we would today call Western Turkey, became a province of Rome. The Roman Empire grew and eventually assimilated other Grecian territories as well. So when we read verses 8 to 12, this part of the prophecy refers to the Roman time period. Jess, do you mind reading those verses for us? Jessica read, therefore, the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. What is the glorious land? Craig asked Peter. Peter relayed the references he'd found in his study that demonstrated this referred to Israel. So the Romans controlled Israel? He clarified. That's right, Craig replied, for quite some time. Remember, when Jesus was on earth, the Jews were in subjection to the Romans. General Pompey conquered Syria and Israel in 60 BC. Drawing Peter's attention to the words, by him the daily sacrifices were taken away and the place of his sanctuary was cast down, Craig asked, do you remember when the Jews were expelled from their land, having just witnessed the destruction of their temple? Peter knew this from the seminars. AD 70, he replied, when the Romans sacked the city of Jerusalem and burnt their temple to the ground. Craig nodded. That's right. In AD 70, the Roman Empire drove the Jews out of their land, scattered them throughout all the nations of the earth, and completely demolished the temple. Even the stones were thrown down as the soldiers searched in vain for rumored gold. Since that time, the ritual daily sacrifices ceased. At that time, Christ's words of warning to the Jewish nation came true, that not one stone shall be left upon another, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Peter made a note of the passage and then asked, "So how exactly did the little horn magnify himself?" The Romans used to call their Caesars a god. He was worshipped, and many Christians lost their lives for refusing to give such homage to a man. Right. Now Peter remembered that this had been the case. So how did he magnify himself even to the Prince of the Host? Well, the Prince of the Host refers to Jesus, Craig stated. What nation was actually responsible for carrying out his crucifixion? Ah, I see. Jesus was crucified by Roman soldiers, Peter replied. Exactly, Craig nodded. The Romans were responsible for actually putting Jesus to death, even though they were only complying with the demand of the Jews. And 40 years later, as we've already said, the Romans scattered the Jews, God's people, into all the earth and destroyed the Jewish temple, which ended the daily sacrifice. You see, Pete, it's all been done. That part of the prophecy was fulfilled almost 2,000 years ago. However, Craig went on to say, verses 23 to 25 of Daniel 8 deal with the time of the end, as in our days, the time just before Christ's return. Today, the empires of Rome and Greece have long come to an end, and yet their influence in philosophy and religion still remains. The great Roman Empire eventually split into East and West, mainly because of a religious controversy over the nature that Jesus bore. Peter sat back in his chair, sipping the hot tea and thinking about what Craig had said. "Good tea," he nodded at Jess. "In fact, I'd say it's as good as your mum's." Jessica blushed. "Thanks," she said. "So, how do you figure out the time factor in this prophecy?" Peter asked Craig, looking back down at Daniel chapter 8. In verse 13 it says, "Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, 'How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?' And he said to me, 'For 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed.'" Using the day for a year principle to calculate prophetic time, Craig told Peter that 2,300 days simply meant 2,300 years. It wasn't hard. But when Peter tried to apply it to the prophecy, he wasn't so sure of the beginning date. "Does this start with the Roman invasion of Jerusalem?" he asked, perplexed. "Because if it does, that means it won't finish until the year 2,370. That's a long time away." "Sometimes it's tricky to determine exactly when a time period starts," Craig admitted. "But if you choose the beginning of this vision as your starting date, which is the battle between the ram and male goat, the 2,300 years ends most significantly." Peter was intrigued. "All right, so when did Alexander fight against the Persians?" "Around the year 334 BC, Alexander was the master of Greece, and in the year 333 BC, he invaded Asia and Jerusalem surrendered without a fight. Try that year, 333 BC. It wasn't simply a matter of adding 2,300 to 333, as the time period before Christ, 333 BC, had to be subtracted from the total first. Peter was very surprised to see that the number that remained was the year 1967. "Why, that's when Israel captured Jerusalem," he exclaimed. "Exactly," Craig smiled. "It was the beginning of the cleansing of the sanctuary, and Jerusalem being trampled underfoot." Peter was still gazing at the verses in astonishment when Jessica suggested they read Luke 21, verse 24. In Luke 21, Jesus predicted what was to come upon the Jewish people. He said, "And they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled." "I can't believe it," Peter remarked, now appreciating the significance of the passage. "Jesus said that Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled," he reiterated. "Does that mean that once the Jews now control Jerusalem, the city is no longer being trampled by the Gentiles? Are we that close to Christ's return?" Craig nodded. "We are, Peter. We most certainly are. When the Jews captured Jerusalem, it was a sign that this prophecy is very close to being fulfilled, but the city is still being trampled to a certain degree. We know from Daniel that the times of the Gentiles equates with the kingdom of men. Jesus has to return to completely destroy the kingdom of men before the kingdom of God will be established in its place." All this information was going beyond just being interesting. A tingle went down Peter's spine. The realization of how close the world was to divine intervention was incredibly exciting and tremendously scary. Peter knew he wasn't ready yet to face his Lord. There were still things that he wanted to resolve, both in his heart and in his understanding. Until then, he didn't feel he could answer the call to repent and let every one of you be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of sins. That night, before he climbed into bed, Peter prayed that God would give him time. "Please, God," he begged, "I know that this whole world is in your hands and that your plans are so much greater than any of mine. But if it is possible, help me to work through this before it's too late. I know you've been very merciful in my life to give me so much longer than I deserve already. It's my own foolishness that has caused me to take so long. But I want to have a part in your promises, and I want to be sure that I understand your truth. Please help me." There were many other things that Peter both pleaded and thanked God for. What he was learning from reading and studying the Bible wasn't just intellectual knowledge any longer. It was powerfully changing his thoughts and his life. As he lay in bed that night, staring wide-eyed at the ceiling, he considered the chain of circumstances that had caused him to stay in Canada and wind up in the Simons' home. He knew full well that it was only by God's mercy that he wasn't still consumed by work and pleasure, intoxicated with the world's entertainment, and totally oblivious to God's wonderful promises. And it wasn't just the traumatic events that had changed him. It was the tiniest, seemingly insignificant happenings as well. If he'd never read the book his mother had raved about and become intrigued about the future, he might never have picked up a Bible or had a desire to return to God. So many words and kindnesses along the way had all contributed to his change of heart. The kingdom prophecies that Jessica and Katie Lee had read to him in the car had convinced him that he wanted to be there. Reading the Bible every evening with the Simons had opened his eyes to all the changes he needed to make in his life. So, if God had brought him this far along, surely he would help him to make it the rest of the way.